He was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Naturally, he became a hero. This week, for our 100th episode, we interview the man who introduced the world to Star Wars way back in November of 1976, Mr. Alan Dean Foster.
You've taken your first step into a larger world. Let's go.
Hello there. I'm Rowan Williams.
And I'm Baz McAllister.
And welcome to Force Material, the show that's all about the secrets and source material of Star Wars. Today, we are honored to be joined by a Star Wars legend and an incredibly interesting man. He's a storyteller, a traveler, an athlete. He studied karate with Chuck Norris, and he just started composing his second symphony, as you do. He's written over 100 books, including three that we'll be particularly focusing on today. The original Star Wars novelization that introduced the world to Star Wars 6 months before the release of the film, Splinter of the Mind's Eye, which was the original Star Wars sequel, and more recently, the novelization of The Force Awakens. He is, obviously, Alan Dean Foster. Alan, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
Now, Alan, we're speaking to you from Australia. You've got some history with Australia, right? You've been out here on some adventures.
Well, it's just one more fascinating part of our very small but very interesting planet. I've been around most of the country except for the top end. The closest I got was, Kings River in northwest Australia.
Uh-huh.
And I've been up the East Coast. I was up the Bruce Highway when it stopped well short of Cooktown. And I've been cage diving for white sharks with Rodney Fox in the Captain Islands out of Port Lincoln. And my wife and I, prior to all of this, stopped in Melbourne and Sydney on our honeymoon in 1975.
Wow.
Even dates Star Wars. We had just come from Bali. We were making a circuit trip around the Western Pacific. And it was somewhat warmer in Bali, and we showed up in Melbourne, and it was raining, and it was cold, and we're running around to secondhand stores, because that's what we could afford at the time, trying to find something like a coat to keep from freezing to death on our honeymoon, and we eventually did. And I have more stories about our honeymoon, but they're not particularly Star Wars related, because Star Wars didn't exist at that time. Australia did, so I have plenty of stories about Oz. I was on the first commercial flight into the Bungle Bungles. There was supposed to be a big fancy flight with the West Australia premier and news people. And there was this crazy Polish pilot who had a small Cessna and ran trips into the area, but not to there. But we flew in the morning before the premier of Western Australia and his group flew in there. So we felt very privileged. Fascinating place, of course. So, yes, I have some history with Australia.
Excellent. How does that sort of, you know, you're a man who loves to travel. How does that experience with travel kind of inform your storytelling, do you think?
Everything is grist for the mill. It's like making a really nice bouillabaisse. You find a little ingredient here, a little spice there, and you put them up on your shelf in your kitchen. And then when you get ready to actually make the dish, you pull them all together and maybe use this and maybe you don't use that. But the idea is to have all of these things lined up that you've sampled before so that when you bring them all together, you have some idea what you're doing. So, yeah, travel has informed my writing since from the very beginning. I never understood when I started writing and I was reading Heinlein and Clark and Asimov and Silverberg, how these people could create believable alien cultures and places without having traveled. And I was really crushed when I went to my first Worldcon, which was in Berkeley, California in 1969, which was an interesting time to be in Berkeley, California. And it disappointed and stunned me when I found out that essentially none of them went anywhere. They did all of their research out of National Geographic and Science magazine back issues. Asimov was famous for not going anywhere. And I didn't know how they could do it. I never felt that I could do that just out of my head. I always felt I had to experience and continue to try to experience as much of this planet as I possibly can so that I get different viewpoints and experience different environments. And that all shows up sooner or later in my writing. There's a little bit of Aboriginal history and culture in a book of mine called Interlopers, just part of it. And a great deal from New Guinea. In fact, I went to New Guinea several times, and my only non-science fiction fantasy novel, a book called Primal Shadows, is all based, strictly based on trips I took to New Guinea. So I think you have to travel. There's other people can do it. It just comes entirely out of their heads. And I can do that to a certain extent, but for most of the time, I can't do that. I need that input.
As a youngster, where did your love of storytelling and science fiction come from?
My father read science fiction, but not much. He didn't have time. He worked very hard at a lousy job. But there was science fiction in the house. There was a copy of, I think it was Fantastic Adventures, which was the original appearance, very dog-eared, and of course that old pulp paper falling apart, that contained Stanley Weinbaum's The Martian Odyssey. My father kept trying to get me to read. He said, this is a really good story, really good. And being the kind of child I was, my father wanted me to do it. I wouldn't do it. So I never read that until decades later, and then I understood what he was talking about. The first science fiction book I ever read was a children's science fiction book called The Spaceship Under the Apple Tree, which I read in the fifth grade, which I believe is still in print. And I was fascinated by the idea of the alien spaceship and the alien and the semi-magical material he needed to get his spaceship going again. And then my father also had a copy of an Isaac Asimov collection, Nine Tomorrows, in the house. And I just sort of never quite got around to picking it up. And then I found a copy of The World of Nolé. And that freaked me out so much. Remember, I'm like 12 at the time, that I didn't touch science fiction for years. Not until my last year in high school, actually, when I was 17. And then I started getting away from the classics and reading more science fiction. So that's how I all got it. That's how I got into it from the beginning.
Your uncle, I think, Howie Horowitz, was a TV producer. Was he sort of an influence on you in terms of, you know, wanting to tell stories?
No, but he should have been. Uncle Howie became a very well-known television producer, a classic television show called 77 Sunset Strip. He produced that. And then later, of course, he produced the TV version of Batman. The camp version, and I have separate stories to tell about that, but this is Star Wars. But I was sort of on the periphery of the business, meaning motion picture and television, my whole life when I was growing up, because Uncle Howie was in the business. So we kept hearing things and stories, and I actually lived with him my junior year at university, so I was even a little bit closer to it. I wrote a two-part Batman episode for when I was a graduate student at, when I was a senior at UCLA, which is where I went. And he was very kind about it, but needless to say, he didn't buy it and use it. Maybe we were too close. Maybe he was afraid, you know, of the old nepotism call, although that doesn't seem to bother other people. But my uncle was really a straight up guy and very professional. I thought it was pretty good. Anybody who wants to read it, it's with the rest of my papers at Arizona State University. But the whole two-part episode was written because, if you remember the Batman series from the 60s, Robin was always saying, holy something, Batman. You know, holy Penguin Batman or holy this Batman. And I wanted them, the whole two-part episode came about because they got involved with some Indian cultists, as I remember, and I wanted Robin to have a chance to say, holy, holy cow, Batman.
Sounds like it was a long walk to get to that line, but I'm sure it would have been worth it.
Hike uphill through the snowy mountains. Yes, it was a long walk. But I was around, he didn't influence me, but I was around the business, and he loved science fiction. He loved science fiction. He desperately wanted to do it. Batman was really the best opportunity he had. But he actually collaborated with Robert Heinlein on a proposed pilot for a half-hour television series. This is in the 50s, to be called The 21st Century, which sounds funny now. It was a time travel story. And years later, I asked Ginny Heinlein, Robert's widow, if she knew where that script was, because it's an important part of Heinlein's legacy, I think. And fans, of course, would be thrilled to see what Heinlein was doing trying to write a television series, but never saw it, and she couldn't find it. She said it's in the files somewhere. So something for somebody to research one of these days.
Hmm. Yeah. Now, we usually ask our guests about their earliest memories of Star Wars, but your involvement with the franchise obviously predates any of that. How did you come to ghostwrite the Star Wars, the original Star Wars novelization for George Lucas?
Okay, as I remember it, studying the fossil record, the story got was someone or someone's involved with the production had read a book of mine called Ice Rigger, which came out in 1973 and was my third novel, and felt that it was similar in spirit to what George Lucas was trying to make in the film. And since I had done novelizations already, that I might be a suitable person to novelize this forthcoming film. Mm-hmm. Ballantine Books, later Del Rey Books, had bought the book rights. And I was asked by my agent if I would be interested, and I said sure, because I knew George's work from THX 1138 and American Graffiti, and I knew this wasn't some schlock project, whatever it was. So I was asked to go see George's lawyer, a gentleman named Tom Pollock, over at his offices on Hollywood Boulevard, which I presumably, so I could be vetted to ascertain that I was not an axe murderer or a child molester. The writing part of it was already secured, I presume. Mm-hmm. And that, well, so they set up an appointment for me to go out to Industrial Light and Magic, which at that time was in a rented warehouse in Van Nuys, California, which is part of the greater Los Angeles area. And I knew exactly where it was because it was less than 10 minutes from where I had grown up in Van Nuys, California. And wow. I drove out there one lovely sunny California day, couldn't find a place to park, because the parking lot for the warehouse in question was full of these wooden sawhorses with big pieces of plywood on top of them. And on top of that were all of these strange plastic things that looked like pieces of building. And these were all turned out to be all the pieces for the trench run at the end of the film. And they were mm-hmm. so big, the individual pieces were so big that they had no room for them in the warehouse. So I had to park down the street. I then went inside, and someone told me George is busy, which I expected, but he'll be with you as soon as he can. So I was free to wander around. Of course, no cell phone cameras in those days, no cell phones. And I wouldn't have broken security by taking pictures anyway, even though there wasn't much security, because after all, this was just some film nobody knew anything about, nobody had heard of. So I busied myself wandering around and watching people sit at tables making things out of model kits that had been cannibalized, which covered these old model kits of World War II battleships and planes and so forth, covered one entire wall of this one big room. And I'm walking around and this guy sees me wandering around. He says, "Would you like to see something interesting?" I said, "Sure, I'm killing time." So he pulls me over and he shows me this enormous, complicated camera rig. He says, "This is the first computer-controlled camera in the history of motion pictures," and proceeds to go into a very technical explanation of what it is that he's built. And of course,
the Dijkstraflex.
John Dijkstra trying to explain the Dijkstraflex to me. And being a writer and young at the time, I didn't have enough sense to pay attention. So I was kind of like, yeah, that's interesting. And wandered off. He said, "Come here, I'll show you where we're shooting some shots." And we go into a room and there's a green screen, and here's the original full-size model, the original model of the Millennium Falcon, and they're doing some shots. It's mounted on a gimbal, and that was actually quite interesting. And then George came out. We kind of said hi, and I'm trying to make small talk, and he's showing me the Death Star, which is about the size of a beach ball, and explaining what they're doing. And he said, what do you think? And I said, it's a great script. I said, if you can get it all up. I was very, very straightforward. I still am, which is why I don't work in movies or politics. If you can get all this up on the screen, I think, I think it'll be a great film. And I thought that for a very long time until it became a great film, and then it was easier. And we talked about this and that, and I asked him one. Said, "What do you want to do?" I'm just trying to make small talk. Remember, what do you want to do, George, if the film is not a big success? And he said, "Well, I have enough money from American Graffiti. I think I'll be all right." And then I said, "Well, what would you like to do if it is a big success?" And he said, "I'd like to make small experimental films." And the interesting thing about that is, a number of years ago, I saw him being interviewed on CBS, the interviewer, I don't know if it was Leslie Stahl or who asked, it said, "What do you want to do now?" And he said, "I'd like to make small experimental films." So the idea has never left him. He just kind of got sidetracked. Anyway, we apparently hit it off. Go ahead.
Oh, no, sorry. I was going to say that's him saying that line, like, "I just want to make small experimental films," has practically become a drinking game on this podcast. Like, anytime we come across a George Lucas interview where he says, "Oh, I'm just going to make small experimental films," it's like he always says it, but I don't know. Maybe he's making them and not showing them to anyone. Who knows?
He ended up making big experimental films.
Yeah.
Part of that stayed anyway, but. So the interview went fine, and at least I presume it did because I got the job. And the contract was for two books, novelize the film and then write a sequel to the film. And the only restriction that was put on me writing the sequel, which was an original novel, was that it had to be filmable on a low budget. The idea being, because George always thinks ahead, the idea being that if Star Wars was neither a big success nor a big flop, he would have something at hand that he could use as the basis for a sequel film that would not cost a lot of money to film, and he could use a lot of the same costumes and props and backdrops. That's why I set Splinter of the Mind's Eye on a fog-shrouded planet. Mm-hmm. Remember, no CGI in those days, so that eliminated the need for a lot of expensive backdrops. What wasn't taking place on a fog-shrouded surface took place underground, which is much easier to build sets for. And that was it. I wrote the book. He liked the novelization. That was fine. No changes were made to that. And he liked Splinter of the Mind's Eye, with one exception. He asked me, there were two exceptions, one of which I can never remember, but it was small. And the other one was, the book originally opened with an entire lead-in chapter which showed Luke and Leia caught in this dogfight above the planet Mimban, and that is what damages their ship and forces them down on the surface. And George had me take that out, not because there was anything wrong with it story-wise, but because it would have been expensive to film. So that's why Splinter of the Mind's Eye essentially starts with Chapter 2.
When you were writing the Star Wars novelization, obviously you'd been to ILM, you'd seen all the wonderful toys, you'd had the script. Did you have any other reference materials to work with, or did you have conversations with George leading into the writing?
George was kind of busy at the time. Mm. In fact, I was surprised he was able to give me as much time as he did. Mm. We were going to talk more, but Saul Bass showed up at ILM. For those of you familiar with motion picture history, that's a legendary name in film. And George wanted to show him some dailies, which I sat in on also, and I knew who Saul Bass was, but I was too shy to go over and interrupt the conversation between the two of them. like everything else now, I wish, hindsight's a wonderful thing. Mm. And I remember Bass congratulating George on the dailies, which was basically just shots of TIE fighters attacking the Millennium Falcon. But I had access to a lot of Ralph McQuarrie's original artwork, which gave me the feel for sure, and certain specifics, but a lot of things like the design for Chewbacca, the cantina scene, all evolved and changed as it went along, but it gave me a general idea for what was going on. And I had pictures of some of the actors, and that was about it. Mm. I didn't have very much in the way of reference material, but I had enough to start with. And even at that point, I was used to creating worlds. So I felt comfortable with what I was doing. There was nothing particularly exotic or out of my range of knowledge at the time. It wasn't hard science fiction. And so it was fairly easy to get into it. And as I say, it was pretty much accepted as written. I did ask one question about this. I asked him, remember the scene that's in the book, but it's not in the film, where Luke meets one of his childhood friends who's just come back from the Space Academy and announces he's going to join the Resistance. And that was filmed. And I asked George, why he cut that out? Because I saw, it wasn't in the film. And he said he felt that the character Biggs Darklighter, he felt that the character Biggs was so strong at that point early on in the film that it overshadowed the character of Luke too much. And I thought about that, and I thought, that's a very sound directorial decision. You're absolutely right. But I was able, of course, to include that and some other things in the book, because the flow is different in the book, and you have a lot more leisure time to spend with subsidiary characters than you do in a two-hour film.
Yeah.
Just as an interesting aside, mentioning Ralph McQuarrie, one of our most recent guests actually owns the original McQuarrie painting of the cover of Splinter of the Mind's Eye. Was it David Rowan? David Mandel?
Yeah, David Mandel, yeah. I think owns. Yeah.
Yeah, David Mandel owns it.
That's the one piece of art from the entire history of Star Wars that I would like to have.
go for it.
Maybe we can arrange a swap somehow.
Yeah, right. I don't have that much blood. But it was such a beautiful painting. The background reminded me a lot. I'd like to talk to McQuarrie about this, but that's not going to happen. If he was influenced by Evan Earle, who did a lot of work like that for the Disney studios, particularly in Sleeping Beauty, the animated film. If you look at the background, the trees and such from that painting, and some of the stylized backgrounds that Earle did for Disney, you'll see a similarity there. The reason, I think everybody probably knows this by now, that you see Luke and Leia from behind is because none of the principals in the film had signed on yet for the use of their likeness in future projects. Mark Hamill hadn't, Carrie Fisher hadn't. So McQuarrie solved this problem very cleverly by showing the characters from behind. Darth Vader from the front, of course, is not a problem. That could be your Uncle Joe. It's the suit that matters. So that's why that was painted. But it turned out, because of that restriction, to be a really impressive piece of artwork. So I thought.
Absolutely. Did you and George sort of share a lot of influences? I mean, George has obviously talked a lot about over the years about how he was inspired by, Akira Kurosawa movies, Flash Gordon, 2001, World War II films, a whole very eclectic sort of pool of influences that he was drawing on. Could you kind of see that in his script? Like, was that stuff that you connected with as well?
I didn't see it in the script so much, but I certainly saw it in the film. But you don't see so much when it's just words on paper. You don't say, this scene is obviously inspired by Throne of Blood by Kurosawa. You don't see it. It's just words on paper. But the one influence that we certainly do share, two influences I can give you. One is Karl Barks, who is one of my two principal literary influences. The other being Herman Melville. I know George was influenced by Barks. I know that Steven Spielberg was influenced by Barks. There's a book of Barks' artwork which has a foreword and an afterword by George. They're both in there. It's almost like a secret handshake. Did you read comic books? Yeah. Did you read Superman? Yeah. Did you read Batman? Yeah. Did you read Uncle Scrooge? Oh, you know Uncle Scrooge. This influence extends remarkably throughout the world of creative people. My favorite band is a Finnish symphonic metal band called Nightwish. And their lead composer, creator of the band, is a man named Tuomas Holopainen. And he wrote a whole suite of music based on Scrooge stories done by Scrooge's successor, Don Rosa. There's another influence which follows through Barks. So that's one thing. The other one is, I always thought my favorite book of all time is The Lost World by Conan Doyle, the original Lost World. Mm-hmm. And the introduction to that book goes, I have done my simple plan. If I give 1 hour of joy to the boy who's half a man or the man who's half a boy. And that's still my favorite novel, even though the science in it now doesn't work. And we know there aren't dinosaurs roaming trees in Venezuela. But the book is so beautifully written. And I saw, I forget exactly where, but George used the same quote. And if you apply that to Star Wars, gender politics aside, it still holds up. So there's two influences that I know we share. There are probably others. But since I don't have a chance to sit down and have coffee with George, it's hard to get through these multiple layers of security. And I don't know what we talk about, but I look forward to his museum in Los Angeles, Museum of Illustrative Art, which is something we don't really have in this country. And I hope I'm around long enough to see it. I've seen some of George's art collection, very little, but there's wonderful stuff. And it's a museum that the art critics will probably, illustrative art. But I guarantee you it's going to fill up every day because it's art that people love. It's art that people love. So that's something else we share, I suppose, is an admiration for, an appreciation for illustrative art.
Mm-hmm. Your original stories, Alan, sometimes have environmental themes. So did you connect with the idea of the Force and the idea of like the villain being more machine than man? Did they kind of appeal to your sensibilities already?
Well, the idea of the villain being as much machine as man appealed to me until I found out that he wasn't. He's just a guy. And that's a whole other thing. George and I would disagree on that, but mm-hmm. I wasn't responsible for making multi-million-dollar movies. As far as environmentalism, there really isn't any in Star Wars. At least nothing overt. There are a lot of interesting environments, but there's nothing that really speaks to ecology. That's something I got from my favorite science fiction writer, a British writer, Eric Frank Russell, who was very, very interested in ecology at a time, the 1940s, when nobody even knew ecology existed, except a few biologists, I suppose. But it was a very strong influence on me. It's been in a lot of my books. The idea that everything is interconnected, that all life forms are interconnected, and that there's this wonderful interlocking mechanism that acts as if the world's greatest Swiss clockmaker put it together, that we're all responsible for. It's just, I could go on and on about that, how reintroducing wolves to Yellowstone National Park has restored the ecology of Yellowstone National Park. You go on and on and list all the connections. And that forms an important theme in a lot of my books, yes. Mm.
We touched on Darth Vader a second ago, and that's kind of an interesting one because, you know, obviously Darth Vader was all over the advertising for the movie, but when you look at sort of early George interviews or even like the transcripts that have been released over the years of your conversations, like it seems like George wasn't convinced early on that Darth Vader like was strong enough to be like the primary villain of the Star Wars story. Did you see Vader as the antagonist of Star Wars from the beginning, or did you see it as Tarkin? I mean, in the book, it seems like it's more Vader, but what was your sort of take on it from the beginning?
Well, I was a little confused by that because in the screenplay, you don't really know who the main villain is. The Emperor has not really entered the picture yet, and you have Tarkin, who's in control of the Death Star. And I kind of saw Vader at that point as his right-hand man. Mm. And he developed and became such a strong character. It's very interesting, not so much because of his appearance, which, speaking of influences, I think owes a lot to the Battle on the Ice sequence from, Alexander Nevsky, Eisenstein's Alexander Nevsky. If you look at the helmet of the Teutonic Warriors, you see the antecedents for Darth Vader's mask and also Japanese samurai armor. There's a combination there. But aside from the mask and the stature, what made Darth Vader for me, and I didn't have this when I was writing the book, or it would have been maybe even a little different, was James Earl Jones' voice. Mm. And that's not there on the printed page. So I didn't see Vader as I was writing the book as the principal villain. I saw him as one of two principal villains. Mm. He was certainly among the interesting character, in, even in the script, than Tarkin was. I mean, Tarkin was an officer, but he was not particularly well defined. He's basically carrying out orders. And you could say that Vader was carrying out Tarkin's orders, but it was, there was always this feeling in the screenplay there that there was more to Vader than appeared in the screenplay. Not as much as eventually developed, but it was there in the original screenplay. He was a much more interesting character. There was no indication that he was anybody's father or anything like that. But yeah, just on his own, you got this feeling that there was somebody giving orders to Tarkin and that Vader was kind of the leader of the Knights Templar, that nobody really knew how powerful he was. And that came out later on in the script. Of course, I was able to use him exclusive of all these other things in Splinter the Mind's Eye.
Yeah. The novel came out like 6 months before the film, obviously, as we said. So, I mean, it's kind of inconceivable that that would happen today, but obviously spoilers weren't a big concern back then.
No, I mean, that wasn't my decision in any case. My job was to write the book, and I had no say, nor did I have any interest in saying when the book should actually appear. That decision you would have to put largely at the feet, I think, of Charles Lippincott, who recently passed away, who was in charge of publicity and advertising for the film. And Charlie was the one who said, you know, we need to get this film out to the fans. We need to go to science fiction conventions. We need to publicize it there because this is our core audience. And if we can get them on board, I mean, I'm not quoting Charlie. If we can get them on board, then they'll spread the word around their neighborhoods and friends and colleges and whatever. And that was, Charlie was brilliant at that. And of course, he went on to work on Alien and produce Judge Dredd and a lot of other things. So it was a unique, and I think first time anybody had done that. It's like, let's get everything out about the film before the film comes out. You just didn't see much of that. You saw it after a film was released, but not so much before the film was released. But I had nothing to do with the publication date.
Now, names like Palpatine and Sith Lord appear in the novel long before they appeared anywhere else. So in the backstory of the novel as well, Palpatine's more of a figurehead than like a master schemer. So were you kind of surprised to learn that, you know, in the what we learn about the Emperor right up until Episode 9, he's turned into this kind of master puppeteer behind the scenes?
Oh, sure. I was surprised as anybody else. But this is what you do, and this is one thing fans like, and I think sometimes studios that have franchises forget this, is that fans, and this is true of fiction as well, fans love nothing better than for a sequel film to pick some apparently obscure character or semi-obscure character from a preceding film, and we suddenly find out that he or she is a lot more than they appeared to be in the original film. Because then they sit there and they think back to the original film, which is good for the studio, or the original novel, which is good for the publisher. They say, wait a minute, I got to go back and rewatch that. Or I've got to go back and reread that. So it's good all around. Also, as an author, it's a lot of fun to do something like that. You can't do it with, you know, a dozen characters, but one or two maybe. It really adds to the depth of any kind of a series, whether it's a book series or a film series. No, nobody had any idea at the time. I certainly didn't. I don't think George did, that Palpatine would become what he became throughout the series.
Did you come up with that name, or did that come from George's notes, Palpatine?
I think that came from George's notes. Sith Lords certainly came from George's notes. But, yeah.
The Journal of the Wills is something else that was sort of introduced in the book that, you know, then didn't appear anywhere else for a long time. Like, in your mind, like, who, you know, did you ever sort of think about, like, who was writing the journal, you know, who they were writing it for? Like, was there a backstory to the Journal of the Wills?
There was no backstory, but I sure thought about it. My idea still is that there's an alien species out there that kind of sits around in the background. I immediately thought of the Wills when I saw Maz Kanata, but that didn't happen. And there's an alien species out there, and they're very unobtrusive, and they don't look like much, but they're sort of the Illuminati of the Star Wars universe. See what's going on. They know what's going on, but they don't interfere. They just chronicle. It's just like, we're just going to write
Watcher and kind of like the Watcher in Marvel Comics.
Which I have not read, so I can't say yes or no. But the name certainly strikes a chord there. The idea that they're all over the, you know, they're around and they make notes and they keep this history, because that's actually what they are, is historians. Mm. Everybody else in the galaxy is dead. The Wills will still be around writing their book. And I love that idea. I love that idea. It's like the monks in Ireland in the Middle Ages, although it didn't turn out so well for them because of the Vikings. but I digress. But I love the idea that there's that species. They're not human. That there's that species there, and all they do is watch and observe and record, because that's what their species does. I always wanted to have one show up in one of the films. I didn't get to use it with Maz Kanata for obvious reasons. And just smile at one of the characters. Originally it was going to be Luke, but I didn't get a chance to do any of this. And just kind of give a little wink, assuming they had eyes that could wink. And you know, where there's a will, there's a way.
Another long walk, but again, it probably would have been worth it. Now, as a kid in the 90s, carrying around my dog-eared copy of the old Star Wars novelization, I remember, now to clarify, I was clearly an idiot, but I remember being very impressed that George Lucas made the movie and wrote the book. And it was only later that I realized that obviously he did not do that. You wrote the book. Did you have any regrets at the time about not being credited?
Any novelization is a work for hire. It's not an original work with you. Some parts are, but it's not your universe. It's your work. If somebody builds a house and the house, the owner, excuse me, says not purple dots, you either paint it green with purple polka dots or you don't take the job. It's a work for hire. It was in the contract that I could not admit to having written the book. And I was with that. It's not my universe. I didn't create Star Wars. The only instance in my entire career where my name was not on the book, but I was fine with it. It was George's story. So I did my job. I cashed my, and that was that.
You obviously, you know, so that first novel went out under the name George Lucas, but the second novel, Splinter of the Mind's Eye, which you mentioned earlier, obviously went out under your name. How much direction did you have from George on that one? Like you mentioned earlier, obviously, it was, you know, he wasn't as involved, he just sort of had a couple of suggestions, but like, was the basic story idea sort of all you, or was he sort of advising, or how did that kind of work with Splinter?
I wrote Splinter before Star Wars came out. And so George was, you know, increasingly frenetic, I'm sure, and had no time for it. We had a meeting at Universal Studios, where George had rented offices at that time, to discuss both books. And with that one exception that I told you about, and the one that I can't remember, he said it was fine. And that was it. As far as direction, I had no other direction other than to write something that could be filmed on a low budget. And the rest of it was all mine. The characters, the relationships, the world, the background. There was mention of the Kyber crystal, and that kind of became the MacGuffin for the story. Well, MacGuffin, right? It's an important component of the story. It's funny after all these years to see the Kyber crystal resurrected and still being used again. Remember what I said earlier about taking something from an earlier film or an earlier book and bringing it forward?
Yeah.
And how much I love that.
Well, you didn't get to write Han Solo in Splinter of the Mind's Eye for, you know, for obvious budgetary reasons, but no. He eventually...
It wasn't budgetary reasons.
Yeah.
Again, Harrison Ford had not signed on for anything, as far as I know, for anything to do with Star Wars. Whether that was a money issue or not, I don't know. I just know that he hadn't signed on. And I was told, when you ask about guidance I was given for the book, I was told I could not use that character. So Han Solo, to me at that time anyway, meant no Chewbacca. That was before we had spinoff novels about Chewbacca's third cousin's uncle. And so no Han Solo, no Chewbacca. That's why they were not in Splinter. Otherwise, I would have used them, sure.
Mm. But Han eventually made his way to Mimban in the Solo movie. So I just wondered how you felt about seeing that finally and seeing the resurrection of Mimban on screen.
I thought that was great. I mean, you know, when you do a work for hire, the person who's paying you, they own your work for hire.
Mm.
And it's up to them whether to credit you for anything or not. I didn't feel bad about it. I thought that was great for the fans.
Mm.
Because I knew that would immediately trigger fan reaction. And I just thought, hey, I created a world here. You paid for it. It's your world. You want to use it in another film in the future? That's fine. I wish they would have asked me occasionally or even once, you know, what do you think we should do for this next film? Or what do you think we should do in this next project? But that never happened. As you probably know, I wrote a partial treatment for episode 9 before episode 9 came out. My agent couldn't get anybody at Disney to look at that. And I said, to hell with it. I'm going to write it for the fans and I'll put it up on my website. And that's what I did. I was trying to do a good story and at the same time fix as many of the problems that were in episode 8 as I possibly could in a logical, science fictional, rational manner. So fans objected to some of the, they liked some of the stuff, they objected to some of the other stuff. And I thought, principally not to go off on a track too long, but I made Rey partially, I gave her partially a cyborg brain, which means she can communicate with the robots, R2-D2, C-3PO, they're simpatico. I don't mean there's a psychic connection. Mm-hmm. And it explains, I was trying to explain how Rey suddenly, with basically no training and no experience, can throw mountains around. And so I thought, well, if she's... Anyway, that's what I did. I did that for the fans since Disney wasn't interested. And it's there for anybody who wants to read it. And I would have gone a different direction anyway with episode 9, but I was trying to fix the problems with episode 8, which I forced myself to sit through. I'm sorry, but we could go on and on about episode 8. It's basically one thing. I'll only say one thing. Episode 8 makes spacecraft totally, or space warcraft totally obsolete, because all you have to do is take an old freighter, send it into light drive, and run it into your enemy, and boom, it's gone. So no more dogfights, no more interesting, you know, battles in space. It's all gone now. It's kind of like with Star Trek, in Star Trek Into Darkness, where Scotty comes up with this thing that looks like a glass version of an old Electrolux vacuum cleaner and says, hey, with this, we can go anywhere in the galaxy now. Okie doke, we don't need spaceships anymore. Goodbye, Starfleet. But people don't think of these things sometimes when they're doing a film, and you'll see a science fiction writer or a science advisor sometimes in the credits down there somewhere between the caterer and the dog wrangler. Basically, so that the people who make the movie can point to that and say, see here on the 432nd line of credits is our science advisor. We had a science advisor. They didn't take any advice from the science advisor, but he's in there. I'm sorry, I'm going off on a rant, aren't I?
That's good.
No, well, I mean, sorry, Bess.
Yeah, I was going to say that there's a sequence in Splinter that really stays with me. And I think it was my version of the thing that freaked you out when you were a kid. Because I read Splinter when I was 9. And I know that because it was 1980. And we were on holiday in Australia, and I, because I'm originally from Ireland, and I picked
never
up.
Never would have guessed.
I picked up the book in Australia, and that's it. I've got it in my hand. That's the very one, and it's stamped with Manly Book Exchange, so I know where I got it. And yeah, so you know, I must have read it when I was a little kid, and I read the underground lake sequence. And that I just found that bone chilling for some reason. It made me feel claustrophobic and scared. Good. And just the precariousness of balancing on the lily pads and everything. So I was just wondering about that scene and how you came up with that, and if anything that you'd seen in your travels kind of inspired that scene up to that point.
I'm trying to think. I'm trying to put dates to things. I don't remember the first time I was in Carlsbad Caverns. in the United States. But I'd always, geology is another interest of mine, shows up in the books too. But I'd always been fascinated by underground formations, speleotherms they're called. And underground lakes struck me as one of the spookiest places you could possibly be. Because unless you have a light, it's pitch black. I mean, everything's pitch black in a cave. But if you're in water, I mean, it's completely destroys your sense of balance and where you are. Because not only are you in a pitch dark environment and a dead silent environment, unless there's water dripping, you're in a secondary atmosphere. You're in water. So it's doubly disorienting. And I've done that. I've used that in another book too, not a novelization, but dark places. It's just the way humans are. Where it's where we went to hide from the saber tooth and the cave bear, and we still have a visceral fear of dark places. And so that's how that little bit came about in the book there.
Now, you mentioned Ray and episode 8 and 9 a second ago. So let's jump ahead to talk about your work on the Force Awakens novelization. That was a film that was shrouded in so much secrecy. Everyone wanted to know what was going to happen in that movie. You were one of the few people who knew in advance what was going to happen. Was that, you know, I mean, obviously you've been around this stuff for decades, but was that exciting for you to get to read that script that the rest of the world was speculating about? And what were your kind of initial thoughts when you read it?
I was absolutely excited. First of all, I like J.J. Abrams' work. Mm-hmm. Second of all, I had seen what he'd done with rebooting Star Trek. And rebooting existing franchises is extremely difficult because no matter what you do, even before you've started page one, you know there are going to be thousands of people who are going to be disappointed in what you do because you didn't do what was floating around in their heads for years. Mm. Never mind if it was good or not. It's not what they expected or they wanted. I thought it was a fine script. I was very happy with it. There were some really neat things in there. I thought it was the most important thing. I thought it was true to the spirit of Star Wars. It treated Star Wars seriously. Very easily could have gone off the rails into camp or comedy. Or something else entirely different. I felt that it was Star Wars and that it was true to Star Wars. And this is before I saw the film. This is just from reading the screenplay. Mm. There were some technical things in there that bothered me. Technical scientific stuff is a particular bugaboo of mine. And one of the things I get to do, if they'll let me do it, when I'm writing a novelization, is fix the bad science. Now, Star Wars is not science fiction. It's science fantasy. It kind of occupies this middle ground. It uses all of the tropes of science fiction, but it's full of fantastical aspects that would never pass muster in real science fiction. And that's fine. That's what it is. But I try to fix those little things in there. And unlike when I wrote the novelization of the first film, there is now a Star Wars story group. Mm. That vets everything down to the color of somebody's shoelaces. And it's not as comfortable a way to work. I can work with it. I did on The Approaching Storm, which we haven't talked about. Mm. I can work with it because I know how Hollywood works. But it's not nearly as comfortable as somebody saying, go write the book. And then you come back and they say the book is fine. Mm. As the writer, that's easy. That never happens in Hollywood unless you control the production, unless you're the producer as well. But I really enjoyed the screenplay. I enjoyed the finished film. If there was a problem with the film, and it wasn't a problem for me, it was a problem for the people making the film, it's that they were charged with an almost impossible task. Mm. It was doing a film that would reboot the franchise and please everybody who loved Star Wars. And as I already mentioned, that just wasn't going to happen no matter what they did. Mm. But what they did do was a very good job. And they posed some new questions. They created some new conflicts, all of which I thought could have been explored in episode 8, and all of which were essentially thrown out the window. Big mistake. Nobody asked me. If they had, I would have given my opinion, which I always do, as I said. Nobody would have paid any attention to it anyway, but I still would have given my opinion. And I would have said, look, you can't do this. It doesn't make any sense logically. And we could go on and on, as I said, about episode 8. Said, here's your big hero who's fought through thick and thin, and basically you turn him into a bitter, stupid old man. And on and on and on and on and on, which has already been done ad infinitum, online, in social groups. So there's no need to go through it again here. But I thought episode 7, which is what we're nominally talking about, The Force Awakens, I thought that did a fine job. I thought it presented an interesting new villain who wasn't developed the way he should have been. I thought there was an interesting new conflict there. I thought Rey's character in episode 7 is not Superwoman. And I thought they should have continued with that. But basically, what episode 7 did in a nice way was reboot the franchise successfully and set up future sequels in a logical, rational manner.
Mm.
The fact that that didn't happen, that wasn't my responsibility, but I feel bad for the fans. I don't care about me for that. I got, as I said, I cashed my check, but the fans deserve better. But I thought episode 7 was fine. Anybody can nitpick in hindsight. I mean, you can nitpick Citizen Kane if you want to sit around and do it. I thought it was a fine film, and I thought it did its job well.
The novel, there's some things in the novel I've been wondering about for years, like in terms of the novel sort of seems to tease some elements of maybe Rey's backstory that then, you know, weren't necessarily followed up in later movies, or they went in another direction in later movies. So one that's always stuck with me is like when Rey catches the saber in her battle with Kylo Ren, Kylo says, "It is you," as if, like, he knows who she is, as if that means something to him. Was that something that was in the script at some point? Did you add that? Like, what did you think Rey's backstory was when you wrote that moment?
That was in the script. I didn't invent that or modify it really in any way. Well, what I thought that meant when I read it in the screenplay and later on when I saw it in the film was that, obviously, Kylo Ren had some idea who she was, or who she represented, because he didn't know her personally, shall we say. But there was something big there that involved Rey, and that should have been explored later on. And it really wasn't. It was just kind of like so many things from episode 7 cast aside. But when I was reading it, I thought, oh boy, remember, I'm reading this as a fan, as a writer. I always do. I thought, wow, this is really interesting. What's their connection? What does he know that Rey doesn't know?
Mm.
And we're going to find out about it in episode. No, we're not. just wasted stuff. There's a lot of stuff that JJ set up in episode 7 that was just thrown away or ignored entirely. And I thought that was one of the big things that was. Shame.
There's also in that scene, like when Rey's fighting Kylo Ren, it seems like in the book, at least, it seems like Rey is kind of tapping into the dark side a little bit, or at least kind of being tempted by the dark side when she fights Kylo Ren. Like she hears a voice, I think, from memory in her head that may or may not be like the Emperor or some sort of dark side force. I mean, again, like, was that something that was scripted, or was that something you added? Like, what did you sort of see? Like, you know, what did you think she was hearing at that moment?
There was just a little hint of that in there, that she could kill him, but there was nothing else. I added all that stuff about the voice in her head, and because I thought it would be really interesting, because good people are often put in that position in real life. It's like, and there've been 8,000 movies done just on this topic alone. It's basically, here's the guy who killed your family. You have a gun. Mm. You're going to turn over the cops, or you're going to shoot him. Mm. And I thought that Rey should have that moment where, because we know she, at least at this point, we know she's and believe she's a good person.
Mm.
And I really wanted her to have that moment, like a lot of people evidently do, where they have to make that decision between self-satisfaction, which would have been accomplished by her killing him on the spot, or not, for whatever reason. Obviously, she's not going to turn him over to the local police. But it's basically that moment where, you know, does your conscience override your primal desire for revenge?
Mm.
And so I developed that there. As to where it came from, I didn't think any further than that at that point. I thought there might come a point with another book or sequel film where that could be explored in more depth. The idea that she might be considering the dark side or not, I didn't have time to develop that. And if I had developed it on that basis, they probably would have cut it.
Mm.
Because at that point, they didn't know where they were going with episode 8. And one thing that the story group does, and probably any story group or similar organization or person at another studio does, is they don't want to put something in there that becomes canon that's uncontrovertible, that you can't change at a later date for reasons of story development.
Mm.
And that would have locked in something. Is Rey considering the dark side? Is she being tempted by the dark side? Would have locked in something that they would have had to deal with.
Mm.
So even if I had explored it further, it probably would have been taken out. This is based on my history doing these things.
Mm. I guess another thing that was slightly different is in your version of Rey's Force vision, she hears a voice say, you know, stay here, I'll come back for you. And, you know, I'll come back, sweetheart, I promise. I mean, I guess we can assume that was her parents. Did you have any thoughts at that point about, like, who her parents were, like if they were significant people?
No, not really. I wondered about it, but I didn't really have time to devote to it.
Mm.
I didn't want to go off on tangents that, again, might be cut anyway from future sequels.
Mm.
And so I didn't get into it. I did when I wrote that treatment for episode 9. Something else I was trying to rationalize was why she was abandoned on Jakku. And that it becomes part of the treatment as well. And I don't need to go into that here. Again, people can read it if they want or not. It's kind of a moot point since episode 9 has come and gone.
Mm.
But I wondered about it. Everybody who watched episode 7 had to wonder about it. She had parents. She got dumped here. Her only point of contact really is this real scumbag merchant in town who isn't even human. Although I did develop that aspect a little bit. I got some flack for that, but people thought that was kind of weird. But I've seen that too with other cultures, not aliens, obviously, but you do get that sometimes. And it's the whole exoticism thing. But no, I didn't have time to develop. There were a lot of things I would love to have written about, but there wasn't. I was doing a novelization of episode 7. I couldn't do a double length book or a triple length book or all these other things that we as viewers wondered about watching episode 7. Would I have liked to? Sure. We all like to make our own movie. I get to come closer than most because I'm doing the novelization. And I can throw things in there, and if they leave things in there, that's great. I'm the 14-year-old kid who gets to add his thing to the storyline. It's funny, though, what they do is they'll take out things that seem so simple and so sensible. That, like, how Rey is suddenly able to fly the Millennium Falcon.
Mm-hmm.
Put that in there having to do with her experience, flitting around in various craft on Jakku's surface.
Mm-hmm.
They left that in, but other things related to the Falcon they took out. But one thing I really desperately wanted to fix was that super weapon.
I was just about really to ask you about that. Yeah, that feels like an Alan Dean Foster director's cut moment, the fixing the Starkiller base.
Thank you. I'll take that. that super weapon was really silly. This is where science fantasy, you're trying to do science and it doesn't work. And I wrote a 4-page letter just about that, which I tried to get to J.J. Abrams, explaining why it was silly and how they could fix it reasonably and not expensively. And as far as I know, never got to him. It's my letter, like my letter to Disney about the black hole and fixing things in post-production, never went anywhere. I do these things as a fan, as much as a writer, if not more so than as a writer. And, I try to explain in the letter, for example, that you can't pull down pieces of the sun because it takes more energy to pull down a piece of the star than it would to use in the first place as a weapon. And you would immediately blow the atmosphere off the planet, and everything on the planet would fry and die. And it kind of went on in that vein, politely.
Mm.
And what I did was propose a weapon that used, I did a lot more research on that thing than I do for most anything I do in a novelization, because I gain nothing from it. It's not original with me, the story. But what I did was do research on a possible planet-destroying weapon. Mm. And it involved looking at a lot of very advanced astrophysics, a small portion of which I thought I could comprehend. And I put it all together, that bouillabaisse analogy again. Yeah. And I came up with something that I thought from the that I would not be ashamed to present to, say, Neil deGrasse Tyson and say, what do you think of this from a scientific standpoint? And it utilized scientific terms, as physicists often do, that sound funny. Things like evanescence and so forth. But it seemed to me a workable planet-busting device, and it utilizes its power source, not a nearby star, but dark energy, which is everywhere. And I thought, hey, dark side, dark energy.
Yeah, it still sounds Star Wars-y.
Yeah, the two had nothing to do with each other from a scientific standpoint, but from a Star Wars standpoint, sounded really cool. Looked cool on the printed page, too. So you have about two pages there of high-energy astrophysics that I thought would work, and I was sure they would cut that. I was sure they would take that out of the book and restore the original Starkiller weapon. And they left it in there. And I think maybe what happened was the physics were so complicated that they either thought it was all woo, as bad science is sometimes called in science fiction, or they didn't understand it, so they probably figured nobody else would understand it either. Mm. Therefore, it would be accepted. And in that respect, they were probably right. I barely understood what I was doing, but I felt that I got it. I glued it all together enough to make a certain kind of sense. And that's the thing in all of the novelization of The Force Awakens that I'm most proud of. I got to fix the Starkiller one.
Yes. I remember like reading the book, and then I had a friend who was like also, you know, really into the movie or whatever, but he hadn't read the book, and just sending him this like incredibly long Facebook message like, oh my God, it's amazing. The book fixes Starkiller base. They do this thing. And he was just like, cool, man. You're like, you know, so obviously it's more of a problem for some people than others, but yeah.
You just nailed it. It's more of a problem for some people than others. And I suspect for 99% of the audience for the film, it was not a problem. Well, I don't know. They were probably so obsessed with previous problems in the film that they already sat through that by the time they got to Starkiller base, it wasn't an issue. Kind of like, yeah, whatever. weapon goes halfway across the galaxy in real time. Not a problem.
Yeah, you can look up during daylight from any planet and see the explosion, the results. Not a problem.
It's just like Spock looking up from that ice moon and seeing Vulcan destroyed. It's like suddenly Vulcan. Yeah. There. And it's just, guys, the thing that bothers me so much about this sort of thing in science fiction films is that it's so easy to fix. You can do it the right logical way, and it'll be just as effective as making garbage. But nobody wants to listen. They get this image in their mind, the people who are making the film, they get an image in their mind. And as James Cameron once said to me, I want that shot. And when you want that shot as a director or producer or controlling actor, everything goes out the window except that shot. So that's not how I do it. But I'm sitting here in Prescott, Arizona, not making movies.
I mean, look, I have to admit, 99% of the time, I am the guy who does not care about the science. I just thought that in the explanation of Starkiller Base using dark energy was particularly, an elegant way to explain what the heck was up with Starkiller Base. So I was a big fan of that. What you mentioned before, obviously you're not a fan of Episode 8, but what did you think of Episode 9, the Rise of Skywalker, and the reveal that Rey was a Palpatine?
I haven't seen Episode 9.
Well, pretend I didn't say anything then.
I was so dumbfounded by Episode 8. I mean, the reason I didn't walk out of the theater halfway through in Episode 8 was because I'd been involved with Star Wars most of my professional life. And I knew that people would ask me questions about it and that I therefore had to see the film in order to be able to answer reasonably. I'm not going to fake seeing episode 9, even though I've read a lot about it, because I haven't seen it.
Mm.
The one thing I can say without having seen it is that I'm sure it's better than episode 8.
Do you think you'll ever see it, or is it a firm sort of foot down, I'm never seeing it situation?
The only way I'd see episode 9 is if they asked me to work on episode 10. And I think because of the way I am, an honest fan and an honest writer, that ain't going to happen. Like I said, I tried with episode 9 with the treatment I wrote. Nobody would look at it. I don't live in Los Angeles deliberately, even though I was raised in Los Angeles. And nobody wants you to sit there in a story conference based on the film, and they've developed this elaborate sequence or shot and have you say, that doesn't work. Mm. For whatever reason, scientifically, story-wise, plot-wise, dialogue-wise, for whatever reason. They don't want you to say, character wouldn't say this, because that's not that character's character. They just don't want that. They want to go make the movie and cash their check and hopefully get good reviews. And that's what they want. The last person they want on the set or involved at the beginning is another writer, particularly one who nobody knows. I don't go to parties. I'm not nice to people that I don't like. I'm diplomatic and tactful. I just kind of walk away, nodding pleasantly. But that's not how you get involved in a lot of these things. I'm sorry that it is that way. Once in a while, a film will come along that's real science fiction. It still happens. One was Arrival, which I thought was terrific.
Mm. Yeah.
Another one was Annihilation,
mm.
which I thought was a great little film. Mm. And what do you know? Both of those films were based on stories by science fiction writers. What a radical idea. And since Denis Villeneuve, I'm getting the name right, directed Arrival, he's doing the new version of Dune, so I have high hopes for that. Because
mm-hmm.
he obviously loves science fiction. And it can be done. A little film called Moon that came out.
Yeah, Duncan Jones movie.
Duncan Jones.
Terrific little film. And I always point people to an older film called Dark City.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which, Wonder of Wonders, starred William Hurt, Jennifer Connelly, and Kiefer Sutherland. Try putting that cast together today for a science fiction film. And it was real science fiction. In fact, Roger Ebert, who I think was the only critic who actually read science fiction, the only film critic, put that on his 10 best films of the year list at the end of that year.
Yeah, he loved it.
That film plays all the time. And you can do real science fiction. You can still do it. It would be very interesting to see what the TV series of Foundation is like. Occasionally, you know, you get it. But you need strong control from the top, and you need people who really like science fiction and understand science fiction. Doesn't happen often, but does happen.
Yeah. As a fan, where would you like to see Star Wars go from this point, ideally?
At this point, we need to get away from the Skywalkers. I think we've gotten away from the Skywalkers. Correct me if I'm wrong, because I haven't seen episode 9.
No, basically, at the end of episode 9, like, it's a clean slate. Like, they could do anything from here. They could skip ahead. They could go back. Like, it's a whole, anything could happen.
Okay, well, prequels are extremely difficult to write. I don't think they should do anything like a prequel. And I think they should, as you say, go off in other directions. The Mandalorian is a good example of that. Mm. It needn't be the only example of that. You can have a Han Solo-like character or a Rey-like, pre-Superwoman Rey-like character, who may not know anything about the Force. I would love to see something else. And you can still tie into the original films. You can still tie into the existing films. Would be wonderful to have, and they're trying to do that with The Mandalorian. You know, I'd love to see Maz Kanata pop up in a cantina somewhere in The Mandalorian.
Mm.
She's just kind of there doing business, and maybe she drops a hint about something that we don't know anything about.
Mm.
And maybe we have this little alien character wander through who's, you know, scribing something in the air and just kind of wanders off. And you think to yourself, is that a will?
Yeah.
And you throw those things in and you can tie anything new. I doubt Disney's listening, but you can tie anything new into all the Star Wars you already have. You just can't, you just shouldn't base new stuff on everything that's gone before. We don't need an episode 10. We need something new. Mm. I think a Mandalorian movie would probably do well if it's true to the movie series. And I can, so you can go off in other directions with other characters and new characters. And I got to do a new character myself. I didn't get to do anything for episode 9, but they asked me to write a short story set in Star Wars based on a character who doesn't even speak in episode 7. Grummar,
yeah.
He's a big game hunter. And then he meets up with this human girl, and they kind of establish this, I don't want to say a love-hate relationship, but they have professional respect for each other once he discovers she's not entirely what she seems to be. It has nothing to do with the Force, apparently. And you could go off and make a movie centered on those characters and explore those characters. I love aliens. Anybody who's read my work knows that. Would be interesting to see a Star Wars film done entirely from the alien point of view, in which humans feature. But so there are lots of directions you can go while still being entirely true to Star Wars and setting them all in the Star Wars universe, hopefully one where the laws of physics apply at least marginally. And Disney would be very happy with the results, I think, and I think fans would be happy as well. For God's sakes, no Force ghosts. That wasn't a good idea. I mean, you know, God bless George, but that wasn't a good idea, because when you start introducing super powerful entities into your story, then the real characters become non-essential. It's like in episode 8, you know, if Yoda can burn trees and burn the entire Jedi library, why doesn't he just port himself onto the Emperor's ship and go boo and solve all the problems? It just doesn't make any sense. You don't want to introduce elements into a story that make no sense.
My headcanon for that was that Akto is kind of a Force nexus, so he can do stuff there that he couldn't do anywhere else, but you don't care about that. So who's the most interesting Star Wars character for you to write about? Like, I know we haven't talked about it today, but I know you loved writing Obi-Wan Kenobi in The Approaching Storm. Like, is he sort of your favorite, or is there another character who stands out above him?
Yoda's my favorite, or at least he was my favorite until he probably watch 400 George Carlin videos in a row. I don't know. But but if I had to pick a character to work with at this point, and again, to explore future possibilities, when I wrote The Approaching Storm, the only thing they gave me was, we want you to feature this character. And it was a female Jedi named Luminara Unduli. And I thought, wow, okay. Didn't know there were any female Jedi. Mm. And her Padawan was interesting. And they're not supposed to be any real, it's supposed to be an ascetic order, the Jedi. They don't have relationships. They don't have sex, which I think is an emotional and story dead end. But now we have a female Jedi. You can do a whole film centered on this gal and her Padawan. And I think that would be fun. I tried to do that with that book to as much as I could, even though it also features Anakin and Obi-Wan. I love taking these subsidiary characters who have interesting story possibilities and putting them in there, like being able to work with another Hutt besides Jabba. I did that because I had no other guidance in Approaching Storm. I know you're running out of time. I'm fine if you want to keep talking. You're doing the editing.
I'm fine. If you're fine, I'm fine. Baz, yeah. Are you fine?
Yeah, I'm fine. Yep, no worries.
How is, when we talk about novelizations, like, how has the availability of home media kind of changed writing novelizations, if it has at all? I mean, I only ask because I imagine part of the appeal of novelizations in the first place and comic book adaptations and those kind of things in the sort of pre-VHS days was that that's the only way people could take the movie home. So, you know, the fact now you can buy, you know, a Blu-ray, you can buy whatever, like, does that change the approach at all?
Well, it doesn't change the approach for me. I don't think it changes the approach for fans, but it certainly changes the approach for publishers.
Mm.
Because the idea is, well, as you say, you know, somebody can buy the director's special edition with, you know, the movie on one DVD and then 12 DVDs of extras. It's just how much more do fans want. The thing with the director's cut and the extra editions, special editions, is that you still have room for expansion. You always have room for expansion in a story. And the only way to really do that with an unlimited budget is in a book, in the novel. And I do think that people, fans, who really love a film also enjoy seeing the printed version of not the film, but an expanded version of it. I can give you one example from The Force Awakens, and this one, you got to give a shout out to the story group. After Finn crashes on Jakku, and there's no sign of Poe, and then suddenly Poe reappears. The story group, after they read the manuscript, and after I had made all the cuts they wanted and changes they wanted, did write and say, could you do something to explain what happened to Poe during the period after we see Finn crashed on Jakku and Poe reappears later on? So there's a whole sequence in there that I wrote where we see Poe stranded in the desert and he's away from Finn, and he doesn't know where the crashed ship is, and he doesn't know where he is to a certain extent. And he needs to get to civilization, and this traitor comes along, and they have a fight with local bandits, essentially. And it was a fun little piece, fun little sequence to write.
Mm.
And in my head, I always see these things as films. And in my head, I'm describing this little piece of film that was never shot that I would love to have seen.
Mm.
Would it have digressed from the main storyline? Maybe, but not so much. Poe's a major character. So there was that. But so getting back to your question, publishers, I don't think, have the same interest in doing novelizations that they used to. It has to be presumed to be the biggest film of the year or one of the top five films of the year. I mean, I don't know what's going on in publishers' minds at this point. But you don't do, for example, it's nice. You don't have to do a novelization of Arrival or a novelization of Annihilation. Because the original stories are right there. I remember back when Blade Runner came out, there was some discussion of doing a novelization.
Mm.
And of course, Blade Runner is based on an actual story by an actual science fiction writer. And my name was mentioned, and I would have felt extremely uncomfortable about doing that, even though the film is quite different from the original story. When Androids Dream of Electric Sheep.
Yeah.
Rewriting another science fiction writer, that's a whole different thing from taking a screenplay and making a book out of it. I had one instance where I actually had to do that, and that was the last Star Trek log, which were the novelizations I did of the Saturday morning animated Star Trek show.
Mm-hmm.
And I saved what I thought were the best stories for last. And the absolute last story was by Larry Niven, who has somewhat of a following among science fiction readers.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt I was uncomfortable doing that because I'm essentially rewriting a story by another science fiction writer.
Mm.
But comes down to professionalism. It's like restoring an artwork. You sign on to do a job, and the person whose screenplay you're adapting signed on to do a job, and he cashed his check, and now you're entitled to cash your check. And if he didn't want the story adapted in the first place, shouldn't have signed on to do the screenplay. Teleplay in this case. Besides, if I hadn't done episode 10, Judy Lindell Ray, who was a diesel of a personality, would have beaten the crap out of me. There are other reasons besides literary ones for doing some of these things.
Well, that's one of the weird sort of quirks of those novelizations. I mean, aren't there, like, there's like novelizations of movies based on Dickens stories, and like there's all sorts of weird, like, you know, snake eating its own tail kind of examples out there.
It's like you do the film version of A Crime and Punishment, and somebody comes to you and says, "You want to do the novelization?" There have been jokes down the line, which I find as funny as anybody else. When David Lynch's version of Dune came out, and people, there would be jokes online and say, "Well, maybe Alan Foster will do the novelization of Dune." You know, the next step of the Bible, you do a novelization of the Bible. My response to that is, well, which film version, because there have been a lot of them, do you want me to do? Do you want God portrayed this way or this way? And does Abraham really fit in the context? I mean, this is what Hollywood will do to your head if you let it.
Yeah, that's right. Away from the writing, you actually hold a senior record in powerlifting, don't you? I was wondering how you got into that. Was that so that Judy Lynn Del Rey couldn't kick your ass?
Oh, dear. The whole powerlifting thing. When I was younger, I'd always played sports, but I was never on a team or anything like that. And there was a science fiction fan named Jerry Jacks. And the first time I met Jerry at a convention, this is pre-Star Wars, He kind of looked like a beach ball. And then the next time I met him, he looked kind of like a pocket Hercules. And, you know, I'm staring, what did you do to yourself? Did you sell your soul or something? So I asked him, he said he took up weightlifting. So that stuck in my mind. And then I encountered the work of a Japanese writer, Yukio Mishima, who was very into martial arts and the whole martial arts aesthetic. And so here was a writer who was also interested in something very athletic. Mm. Not an athlete who had become a writer. The other way around. And I played basketball and swam just because I felt you had to stay healthy in order to be able to do anything else in life. And I got to the point to where I'm 60 years old. I lost a tendon in one arm playing basketball. And I thought, well, this is stupid. You know, you're out there trying to rebound with 18-year-olds. What can I do to stay in some kind of physical shape? And I'd always thought powerlifting, not bodybuilding, but powerlifting was interesting. So I started doing that for exercise. And one day at the gym, the YMCA, a guy came over to me and said, you're doing pretty good there. Have you ever thought of competing? And I said, oh, come on, all these guys are built like trolls. And he said, you don't understand. You compete in your own age group as well as your own weight group. And I thought about it, and I started training with this gentleman. And I got pretty good, and I said, I'll try one meet, and I did. And because of my age, they break every 5 years. So at this point, I'm in the 60 to 64 age group. Now, when lifters get over, say, 50, 55, they either have done everything they want to do and they don't want to do it anymore, competitors, or they're so busted up from competing that they can't do it anymore. So I was the only guy in my age and weight class, and I got a nice trophy. I thought, hey, this is fun. And then I started, after a year or two, taking it fairly seriously, going to the gym 4 days a week, having a real program. And after I entered the 65 to 69 age group, you suddenly are in a group where there are maybe a dozen people in the country that you're liable to see at a major meet in your age and weight group, if that. And there are, of course, different federations, just like boxing or wrestling. Mm. But this one was all drug-free and no extra equipment, no weight belts, for example, no wrist wraps, things like that, no special lifting shirts. And I set a bunch of state records and one world record, which I think are still up there.
Wow.
For somebody who'd never done athletics in school or college, I thought, well, this is the revenge of the nerds. This is pretty cool.
Yes.
And I still lift, or I will when they reopen the gyms in this country again. But I do what I can at home, and I'm pretty pleased with what I've been able to do. I think it's important. I would go to science fiction conventions, and I would see people whose heroes were Conan. or Superman, and they look like they had never exercised in their lives. And I understand some of that is due to medical conditions and some of it is due to genetics. But there were other people who simply just sat on their butts and ate too much of the wrong food. And I was kind of like, you know, you admire these people in fiction. Why don't you put some of that in your own life? And I'm a firm believer that you stay as healthy as you possibly can stay. That's the whole powerlifting thing. Uh-huh. Then the music, you know, because I'm stuck pretty much at home because of coronavirus, I started, well, what can I do that I haven't done before? So in April, I started writing orchestral music.
As you do?
Yeah.
How's that going so far?
It's a lot of work. It's kind of like learning another language.
Yeah.
In fact, it's very similar to learning another language. The writing is different. The grammar is different. But if you learn the words, as you learn the words, you know, you learn the notes, you put this here and this here. I'd grown up listening to classical music my whole life. So I can tell from listening to it how an oboe is different from a bassoon, let's say. Mm. So I didn't have any problem with that. But there's a great deal to learn from the beginning. And I've written several short pieces and a symphonic suite and one symphony. And I've just started the second symphony. So
that's great.
Whether anybody will ever play any of them or not, I don't know. It's all done with software. They have what they call sound fonts, kind of like word fonts.
Uh-huh.
And the sound I use with my software that comes with the software I'm using is just not really well developed. It's perfectly adequate. And if you play it back, sounds like music, but it's not a professional sound font, let's say. And it's certainly not the equal of a professional performance. The brass doesn't sound like the brass quite should sound. And the strings are okay and the woodwinds are okay. But, you know, it's you get what you pay for, essentially. It's not the same as a live performance. The nuances aren't there. But for somebody who never could sound out Ring Around the Rosie on the piano, I consider it an accomplishment of sorts. Mm.
You should reach out to Nightwish and see if they're up for a collaboration.
First of all, the composer for Nightwish, Tuomas Holopainen, doesn't need any help. Although he is also, as I mentioned, a huge Scrooge fan.
Yeah.
But the symphonic suite I just mentioned, actually, there are six members of the band. And I wrote a little symphonic impression, about 2 minutes long, each piece of each member of the band. And if you go on YouTube and you put in Nightwish suite, the six pieces will come up and people can listen to them.
You, as part of your life as a Renaissance man, you also studied karate with Chuck Norris pre movie stardom for Chuck. What's the story there? How did that happen?
My parents, since I was a bookworm, that was the word we used before nerd came along, thought I needed to know how to defend myself. So when I was, 11 years old, they put me in judo classes for 6 months. And I sort of liked that. I was tall for my age at the time. I'm certainly not anymore. But I did well at it. And ignore that. It's all spam. Even though I've got a block on the phone, the spammers are clever. Many years went by. I got interested in Japanese martial arts, Korean martial arts in this case. And I thought this would be something useful. I'm always interested in learning another skill, whether it's how to sail a boat or how to scuba dive. I thought this would be an interesting skill. And at the time, Chuck had 7 or 8, dojos, karate schools scattered around Los Angeles. And you would have an individual instructor, and then he would rotate between the schools to give lessons also. And I didn't know anything about karate, but there was a studio close to where I was living at the time. This is with my parents, so this is very early on. Mm-hmm. And I started going and learning. I went for 3 years. I did test for black belt, failed, which a lot of people do the first time they try for black belt. Half the people on my panel, which was very intimidating, it was like 7 people on this judging panel, half of them were in the movie Enter the Dragon.
Oh, my God.
And so it's Chuck Norris and his brother Aaron Norris, who was my principal and instructor when I became an advanced student. And Bob Wall, who's the principal villain in that film, and a lot of other people. It was a very intimidating panel, and there were some instructional things that I hadn't been taught. I didn't say anything. And so I failed, and I went to live in Tahiti for 3 months and figured I would pick up when I came back. And when I came back, all of Chuck had closed all of his studios. And I think what happened, although I don't know this, but I think this is what happened, is Steve McQueen, in my last year in karate, used to come into our studio for private lessons with Chuck. And I think what he said was, you know, why are you fooling around with these little karate schools? Let me introduce you to some people and we'll get you in the movies.
Yeah, right.
And I think that's what happened, although I've never seen Chuck Norris since those days. He still owes me a first red certificate. I never got that.
did you have any inkling that Chuck was you know, did you see any movie star potential in him, or was he just that guy who teaches you karate?
I saw zero movie star potential. Very soft-spoken. He is not a dominating physical figure like, say, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Mm. He's very quiet, but he moves, or I know he moves now, he moves at least. But back then, he moved like lightning. And I did one demo with him. I was the dummy in the demo, but that's fine. And he would tap you lightly, and it was like being hit by a cast iron stove. So to be hit hard by him, you can't even imagine what that would be like. It would be like a comic strip thing where his fist would go completely through your torso and come out. But I learned a lot. 3 years, if you pay attention at anything for 3 years, you're going to learn something. And I felt I learned two or three things well. And it made me a more confident person when I was walking around, you know, some city in Africa or South America or something. I felt I could, to a certain extent, at least take care of myself. Mm. Also, it was fun. It was very enjoyable.
Obviously, at the moment, with all of this coronavirus stuff that's going on, travel is you know off the agenda. But what are the dream destinations for you that you haven't had a chance to get to yet?
I don't really have any dream destinations. I'm very fortunate. I've pretty much been to every place that I really wanted to go. There are still some places I would like to go very much. There are some places I would like to go back to. But as far as places that, you know, if I were to die tomorrow, is there some place I haven't been that I really wanted to go? It doesn't exist. The last place, which I kept saving, was Paris. Mm. And I went about a year and a half ago, and I only had a week. For various reasons. I used to go for 6 weeks at a time to places like New Guinea, because when you go to places like that, you need time, because the plane may not show up, or the boat may sink, or the road may be closed by people fighting a revolution or who knows what. But I only went for a week, and it was great. It was a wonderful week, and I go the way I always go. My wife used to travel with me. She hasn't been able to do that for years for health reasons. I did take a couple of trips with other people, friends, both times with artists, which was interesting in itself. And I feel I travel well with people if you have similar interests. But most of the time on all of these trips that I've taken, I've gone by myself. And it lets you wander around at your own speed and go see what you want and linger over what you want to linger over and skip things you want to skip. And you blend in, if you do a little homework before you go, you can blend in with the local populace. My last day in Paris, somebody from the south of France, some couple, asked me for directions. That's when you know you've arrived as a traveler. I was wearing all black. That seems to be a thing.
Yeah.
I had no backpack. I had no camera hanging off of me. You can blend in. Of course, I couldn't give them any directions because I basically said, I'm a stranger here myself. And once I spoke English, they realized, you know, that I wasn't a local. But for example, if you can ride on the metro, the subway at rush hour, tourists don't ride the metro at rush hour. Mm. But I wanted to do that. And it's exactly what you would expect it to be. But nobody looked twice at me. Nobody looked at me like, oh, you must be a tourist or you must be an American or whatever. because you blend in. The best way to do that, you study beforehand, you learn the customs, you learn some of the language. Everybody, I don't care if you never spoke a foreign language in your life, everybody can learn how to say thank you, please, where is, and goodbye.
Yeah.
Everybody can do that, but people don't even try. Part of the problem is people travel on, you know, in groups, and I understand fear and all of that. But if you travel on a tour bus, the only people you meet and talk to are the other people on the tour. Mm. You don't meet local people. You don't have local experiences. So anyway, Paris was great. Best sorbet I've ever had in my life. And I don't even like sorbet. And people say, you know, what was your best experience in Paris? Bearing in mind, I only had a week, 6 days, actually. I went to a concert at Notre Dame before it burned. That was wonderful. I saw all these paintings that you see in books. I saw the actual paintings in places like the Musée d'Orsay and the Louvre and other smaller museums, which were wonderful. I walked all over the place, which is how you really get the sense of any city you need, or any place. You need to walk. You need to get on foot. But my best experience was finding out where the nominally best ice cream place in Paris was. It's a place called Bertillon. And it's on the island that's south of the island where Notre Dame is located. And buying a little cup with one scoop of dark chocolate ice cream and two scoops of raspberry sorbet and walking down the stairs onto the quay on the Seine. This is in October. No tourists. There are hardly few tourists there in October. And sitting there watching the Seine flow by and Notre Dame is off on one side, eating ice cream and sorbet. That was the best experience I had in Paris. And those are the kind of experiences you get when you travel, only if you travel by yourself or maybe one other person and let yourself just go.
Mm. Is there anywhere in the world, like particularly sort of off the beaten path or whatever, that you would recommend people go to? I kind of like the idea of going somewhere one day and being like, Alan Dean Foster sent me. This is, you know, he recommended I should check this out.
Depends what you want to go for. If you want to go to animals, you go one place. If you want culture, you go to another place. If you want history, you go to another place. It just depends what you want. If you want a really I'll name a few things. If you want a really exotic experience that really takes you out of the 20th century, 21st century, as much as it possibly can, go to Papua New Guinea.
Mm-hmm.
This is still probably the most primitive, the Central Highlands, still the most primitive place in the world. It's a dangerous place. Can be a dangerous place. You need to be mentally and emotionally prepared for things, but you will see fabulous creatures, birds of paradise, people living the way they, you know, partially the way they did hundreds of years ago.
Mm.
You'll see some guy walking around with a grass skirt and an AC/DC t-shirt that he got, you know, used or a missionary group gave them to them. But you can still see fascinating things. They do two things in New Guinea every year. They're called Sing Sings. They do more than that. But it's kind of like an American Indian powwow. And you get 100, 120 singing dancing groups come out of the forest, literally. And each one has a completely different costume, decorated, handed down through generations, with amazing headdresses. You can, again, look at all this stuff online. Made of birds of paradise feathers and exotic flowers and plants. And for 2 days, they go out on a soccer field, either in Mount Hagen or Goroka, which are both mountain towns, and they dance and sing in competition. And it's like it's literally like being in a National Geographic special. The other thing I would recommend to people for culture is every 4 years, there's something called the Festival of the Pacific Arts, which is sponsored by a French cultural group. And the idea is to bring people from all over the Pacific, mostly the island nations, together to swap ideas and drawings. And you see, and every country, of course, sends its best people. So if you only have but one chance to go to the South Pacific, and this is only every 4 years, go to the Festival of the Pacific Arts, and you will see the best dancers from the Solomon Islands and the best wood carvers from the Marquesas and the best singers from Rapa Nui, all in one place. It lasts for 2 weeks. 1 week is fine. People bring wonderful things to sell that you're not going to see anyplace else. So that's highly recommended. I think this year it's in Guam, which would be very easy. But I was at the one in Palau, very interesting little country, in 2004, and ran the writing program. So all the arts are included. And the end result was the stories were really good that I got from local people. And I thought these should be kept. So I went to the local director, representing the Furniture Society, can't remember the full name, and said, maybe we could do some Xerox copies, 15, 20 copies of this and put one in the local museum, that sort of thing. And I gave her the manuscript that I had put together. And she said, let me see what we can do with this. And the result, many months later, after I'd completely forgotten about it, was a beautiful book with handmade end papers and illustrations called Short Stories from Small Islands, which is the title I gave it. And it's all long since sold out, both in English and French. But if you ever see a copy, that was a fun project. So that's for culture. For history, Turkey is a great place to go. Istanbul is one of the world's most wonderful cities. The government right now could use some work. It's sort of the Turkish version of Episode 8, but it's a wonderful country. The food is fabulous. And if you get out of the tourist areas, which are worth seeing, and you go to some place like Safranbolu, which is a town in the north, which is all preserved 19th century Turkish buildings. And that's the kind of place where the local people go from Istanbul for a vacation or a getaway. And there's an archaeological site in the south, the southern mountains, that a Belgian team of archaeologists has been working on for decades called Sagalassos. And unlike a lot of the ancient Roman cities, it wasn't taken apart to use the building materials to make mosques and markets and other things. Still, basically, all the parts are there, even though there have been a lot of earthquakes. They're gradually restoring it. It's an astounding place. When I was there was one other tourist there the whole day. But it's a remarkable place. One of the first buildings they restored was the original fountain house. And there's a spring. The water comes out and then runs in two directions around in a, a little conduit where people would fill their jugs for water. It's a 2,000-year-old spring. And the water tastes just as good as it probably did 2,000 years ago. How often can you do something like that in your life?
Yeah.
So I recommend Turkey and Prague. Prague is one major city in Europe that wasn't bombed during World War II. That's why they shot Amadeus there instead of in Vienna, because you still have all these original buildings that are intact. And if you like Art Nouveau, which I love, that's the place to go. So there's culture. There's that. For animals, you want to go to Kruger National Park in South Africa, which is bigger than Switzerland. And even though there are a lot of tourists, it's so big, you can actually, if you have a rental car, which is a way to do it, get off by yourself and you will see lots of animals. The other place would be Manu National Park in Peru, which is the size of New Jersey and is still very much National Geographic type territory. There's only one place to stay inside the park and only one or two places to stay right on the boundaries outside. And you will see the kinds of animals that you see in National Geographic and Discovery Channel videos. So places like this, animals, culture, history, they still exist. And people can still see them. But you have to get out there and you don't want to go if you can manage it. I understand why people go on tours, package tours. But if you can manage it, don't go on a package tour. People ask, what's the most beautiful place you've ever been? And I live 2 hours from the Grand Canyon, so that's one of them. And the other three, there's the Lofoten Islands off the coast of Norway, which are very easy to get to, which looks like something out of Tolkien. They're basically these mountainous islands that rise straight up out of the water with little fishing villages on them. Amazing place. There's Angel Falls, which is the tallest waterfall in the world, which features prominently, although it's not called that, in the Pixar film Up. That's essentially Angel Falls. And if you go with the right group, there's only one group, they have a place to stay at the night. Otherwise, You go up in a boat all day, you stop, you look at the falls for an hour or two, and you go back in the boat. But if you go with this other group, you stay in a little rustic place overnight, and then you hike up to the base of the falls the next morning, which is a couple of hours hike uphill through the jungle, but it's doable. And there's a pool there, and you can go swimming at the base of the world's tallest waterfall. Very cool. But the number one place, if I had to pick one, and it also features in a scene in a Star Wars movie, is Iguazu Falls in Brazil and Argentina, which it looks like it was designed by a science fiction artist or a fantasy artist. You basically have a couple of hundred waterfalls scattered across a two-mile stretch of river, interspersed with little islands full of rainforest, with tropical birds flying around and monkeys in the trees. It's an astounding place, just an astounding place. And I'll leave it. I'm not going to point it out. It's no fun giving everything away. But there is a major scene. It goes on for a minute or two in one of the first Star Wars prequels that was shot at Iguazu Falls.
Well, there you go.
So there's my travel advice.
That's fantastic. Thanks so much for that. What's next for you writing-wise? Are you working on any books during this period?
Well, there's the Second Symphony, mentioned, and I'm working on a novel. I'm about halfway through, called Lost on Paradise, and I have two books out waiting for a publisher. One is called Secretions. You mentioned ecology. The ecology of this world is all based on slime, which, when you get into it scientifically speaking, is actually fascinating stuff. And another book called Prodigals, which I had never written an alien invasion story. So this is an alien invasion story with a couple of twists. Can you guys hold for 1 minute?
Yeah, for sure.
That was my better half. my study is in a separate building, which conveniently for both of us has a separate phone number. The way she gets in touch with me is, you know, she calls my number. And that's great because I get all the spam she doesn't get. And it beats an intercom and various other devices.
Yeah.
I originally didn't want a separate study. We have a modest sized house with spare bedrooms, and I was going to take one of the spare bedrooms when we bought this house in 1980 and turn it into my study. And she said, no, you can't do that. My wife is from a small town in Texas, a really unique gal. And she said, you got to have a separate building so I can play my music loud. Yeah. She really introduced me to hard rock and metal and blues. So we had a garage, and I converted the second floor into a study. And I don't know how much of this you can see, but there are a lot of books, lots and lots of books, and paintings and sculptures and things from my travels.
Oh my gosh!
I think an author's study, where an author works, or any artist where they work, tells you more about the artist, be they a composer, a painter, sculptor, than anything in their house. Mm. See little bits and pieces of their life.
Have you ever been to the Studio Ghibli Museum in Tokyo?
Alas, no. We were in Tokyo for about a week on our honeymoon, part of that circum-Pacific honeymoon we had. But I didn't know. I'm a big animation fan, so I have no excuse.
Well, the only reason I ask is they've done a similar thing with that. There's a section of that museum where they've essentially tried to like recreate Miyazaki's study. Like, so rather than it being a really structured museum, they've just tried to, you know, they've got pictures or whatever of his working space and the kinds of things that he has up, and they've tried to like recreate that exactly.
That's great if you can find that. It tells you so much about the person and about the art. If you go to Prague, Alfons Mucha, who was the greatest proponent of art, the greatest artist of the Art Nouveau era, his whole studio is there, all set up and everything ready for him to paint. And that's a great thing to say, to see. Mm. If you go to London, one of the things that people miss is Handel's house is there. And you can see the piano where he composed the Messiah.
Wow.
Little things like that. You know, people go to the Tower of London to see the crown jewels. And they go to London Bridge. They go to Westminster Abbey, which is all great. But I love little things like this. There's a place in London, speaking of culture and things to see when you travel, called Sir John Soane's Museum. And Sir John Soane was an architect. He designed the front of the Bank of England, things like that. So we're talking late 1700s, early 1800s. And in his will, he said, I'm leaving money so that my house, which is like a narrow five-story London townhouse, so that my house shall be preserved exactly as it is on the day of my death. So if you go in there, you're walking into an early 19th century gentleman's home, exactly as it was. The book he was reading is open on a table, exactly as it was when he died. Very cool. Not a lot of people go there. There are about 10 Turners in there, too, if you're interested in art.
Wow.
In his house. Because he bought them, you know, when they were new and great stuff.
Yeah.
Amazing. We should let you go, but thank you so much for taking the time. This has been amazing. Yeah. For people who obviously, you know, there's lots of your work to track down out there, but where's the easiest place for people to keep up with you on the internet? I imagine it'd be your homepage.
Yeah, I'm not much of a social animal. I do a monthly update it's very short, once a month on my homepage, but there is a lot of other information on that page about myself and my writings. So if people are interested in those things, that's a good place to find them. There's also a Facebook page maintained by Open Road Media, one of my publishers, and find some things there you won't find someplace else. I have a YouTube channel, but there's nothing on it except that Nightwish tweet that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the only time I ever flew anywhere to go to a concert, there was a British composer named Havergal O'Brien. Very interesting guy, lived to be 96, self-taught, wrote the piece of music that's in the Guinness Book of Records as requiring the largest orchestral forces of any published piece of music. It's called the Gothic Symphony. There have been very few performances, one of which was in Brisbane in 2010 or 2011, which you guys should look up, a film called The Curse of the Gothic, because it's all shot in Brisbane, where they managed to put this thing on.
Awesome. I don't think I've ever even heard of it.
No, most people haven't, but they did manage to put on a performance. But the London performance is the only one that does it exactly the way the composer said. There are 990 performers at the Royal Albert Hall, 4 choirs, 2 children's choirs, 4 soloists, 3 scattered around the auditorium, what they call symphonic bands. And it is maybe the most extraordinary piece of music I've ever heard in my life. It's 2 hours long. There's a good recording on Hyperion of that concert. And I was able to go to the final rehearsal, brought my video camera, intending to videotape as much of it as I could, video record, whatever. And I got 8.5 minutes in high definition, good sound, before one of the BBC people came over and said, no video. But there's 8.5 minutes, and you can see all of the performers and hear a little bit of the music. And it's just an extraordinary thing. You'll hear something that reminds you of Vaughan Williams or something that reminds you of Richard Strauss, and then something will come out of the orchestra like nothing you've ever heard before. One more thing, and then I'll let you go. I know it's supposed to be really Have any of you played a Star Wars game that includes a piece of music called Sugan Asena?
I don't know. I don't think okay. so.
Okay. I forget the name of the Star Wars game, unfortunately, but it's Star Wars Force of Empire, something like that. But there's a Mongolian folk metal band called the Hu, H-U. extraordinary stuff. You can see all of their videos online, too. And it seems that
it's from Fallen Order, the game. I'm playing that at the moment.
It's the music culturally right now.
Well, they took one of their songs because somebody heard it and said, somebody connected with LucasArts heard it and said, this would be great for this game. So what they did was they modified the language from Mongolian to something that sounds like Mongolian, but now it's a Star Wars language. And they took a song of theirs called Black Thunder, and now it's called Suga and Asena, and it's in this game. And you can see them just playing it in the studio. Very much worth seeing. Sound, it's extraordinary sound. They do Mongolian throat singing, and the instruments are wonderful, but it's essentially folk metal. Wonderful stuff, and it's kind of nice that it ended up in Star Wars. So there we've come kind of full circle.
Yeah.
Yes. Even though we didn't start at that particular circle, but what the heck?
We started with travel, so you know it all sort of connects up.
There you go. So there's some things for you to look at and listen to. Some by me, and something by the Who.
Well, there you go, guys. That is where you can find Alan and plenty of recommendations from Alan to check out as well. In the meantime, if you're looking for us on the internet, we are very easy to find at forcematerial.com. Also, we're at Force Material on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Mostly Twitter, if we're honest. If you have a message for us that cannot be constrained by the limits of social media, feel free to hit us up at forcematerial@gmail.com. And if you enjoyed this interview with Alan, feel free to give us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice. I'm not going to say no. Baz isn't going to say no. I'm sure Alan wouldn't say no. Oh, sorry. It looks like Alan has something to say there.
The book coming out from Centipede Press later this year called The Director Should Have Shot You, which is a history of all my involvement with novelizations.
Well, there you go. I read somewhere that you were working on that, but I didn't know it was coming out soon. That's awesome. So check that one out as well, guys. I'm Rowan Williams.
I'm Baz McAllister.
And I'm Alan Dean Foster.
And you've just taken your first step into a larger world.